Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Kling, working behind the scenes this week. Coming up on this special midweek edition of the podcast, two interviews. We'll talk with Vidya Peters of Marqeta about mobile wallet payment platforms and their adoption by consumers over the last 9 months. We'll also talk about a report via CBRE, who held a media conference this week, to talk about their annual reverse logistics report. And we'll discuss with Carl Haller, IBM's Home for the Holidays report. A reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be through Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy the podcast, go ahead and give us a rating. It helps others to find us, and certainly heard from a lot via various different platforms regarding our recent shows. Glad you're enjoying what we've brought to the table over the last couple of months. Additionally, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. So let's lead with Carl Haller. Once again, a partner with the Global Business Services Consulting Unit and Consumer Center of Competency Leader at IBM, he joins us to discuss not only their Home for the Holidays report, but more specifically, their data showing that consumers may now be more willing to shop based on their values and based on the values of the retailers they buy from versus some other factors. No matter which outlet or research firm you look to, one thing is certain: year over year, more sales will touch digital channels in 2020 than ever. This results in sometimes those piles of boxes you see on porches this time of the year, but all that cardboard, the increase in logistics, transportation, and single products going to homes rather than truckloads going to stores has to have some type of negative effect on the environment, right? Well, we can't answer that question specifically, but we can certainly talk about how shoppers' decisions during the holiday season are shaped by their values. And to that end, we welcome back Carl Haller, the Consumer Center of Competency Leader at IBM, to the podcast. IBM's recent research brief, Home for the Holidays, dives into this topic and many others. Carl, welcome back to the show.
Trent, thanks. Happy to be back.
So first, I was wondering if you could provide just a bit of a backdrop behind this research in terms of who was surveyed for the Home for the Holidays research brief and how you went about collecting data there.
Sure. So this was an online survey. It was 12,500 consumers across 8 countries, U.S., Brazil, Canada, Germany, India, Mexico, Spain, and the U.K. About 2,500 of those were in the U.S., and it was focused on how consumers are thinking and how they plan to behave with regard to shopping, travel, and vacation amid, you know, what is a very odd holiday season for most of us.
All right. So a lot of the findings in the survey kind of dovetailed with things that a lot of people have talked about to this point. Obviously, increased push towards e-commerce, buy online, pickup in store, that type of thing. One of the findings we're going to focus on is other factors that consumers are taking into account besides price. We know that price, convenience, usually still king when it comes to shopping decisions, but what are some other things that the survey found regarding what people are taking into account when they decide where and what to buy and how to buy?
Yeah, sure. So we actually continued with this survey some work that we had done a year ago, where we actually did a survey of, almost 30,000 consumers across 28 countries, where we really delved into this topic in a lot of detail. And what we've seen is that while some attitudes and behaviors, I would say, took a bit of a pause, you know, during the beginning and middle of the COVID period, as people's mindset turned toward personal and family safety and health, we're seeing a bit of a resurgence in the idea of aligning where you shop and the types of products and brands that you shop for with personal values. When we talked to consumers a year ago, and as you mentioned, a decent proportion, 41% globally, did say that price, convenience, selection, the kind of basics, were the most important factors when choosing products to shop and brands to shop for. But 40%, you know, virtually statistically the same, said that they choose brands primarily based on how those brands align with their personal values. So what we're seeing is that now values is just as important as value to consumers around the world.
One of the things that I thought was most interesting, especially regarding this most recent survey, you talked about it, about one-fifth of the participants were from the U.S., but you surveyed a healthy number of people globally as well, and it seems like the numbers changed a little bit from global region to global region. Is that right?
Yeah, it's definitely true. And in fact, when we get into this idea of sustainability and reducing environmental impact, actually the U.S. is a bit of a laggard. So overall, we had 54% of consumers saying that they were willing to change their holiday purchasing habits to help reduce environmental impact. And that's consistent with what we found a year ago. So we were pretty encouraged that that's going to be a lasting mindset shift for consumers. But the U.S. was kind of at the bottom of the scale. In the U.S., that number was only 37%. The U.K. was only 40% compared to some of the leading countries. Brazil, which was 66% of consumers, said they would be willing to change their holiday purchasing behavior. Mexico, 74%. India, also 74%. You really do have some splits and some divergent behavior when you look country by country.
So as you mentioned, you got around half of consumers that said they'd be willing to change their holiday purchasing habits globally, at least, to help reduce environmental impact. What are some ways in which we're either seeing that borne out already, or we could see that bear out as this holiday shopping season continues?
You really see it in a whole number of ways. You see some people, frankly, reducing what they're buying and reducing what they're spending because they're recognizing the impact on the planet of our consumerism. And, you know, one of the themes that we did see coming out of this survey is a bit of a retrenchment. And certainly, that's not all sustainably driven. That's, you know, a lot of that is COVID driven, but we are seeing a reduction in the number of people that the consumers were responding, the respondents to the survey were saying they were buying gifts for. So we had 29% of people saying they were buying gifts for fewer people than last year, only 14% saying they were buying more. We also are seeing spending decline. Planned spending declined by about 19% versus last year. So, you know, we're seeing some reduction in overall consumption. We're also seeing, and this is enabled by, you know, a number of retailers, we're seeing more options in terms of fulfillment. So buying online and picking up in store where the consumer might be, you know, if they're in a city, they might be walking or biking or taking the subway to a store. We're seeing some retailers bundle packages together so they can come during a preset time, and you're running fewer trucks or you're sending fewer boxes in the mail. You know, really, there are a whole host of things on the consumer side and on the retail side.
You mentioned certainly retailers moving towards a more sustainable platform for a number of reasons, not only environmental impacts, but also consistency within supply chain. You mentioned bundling packages or bundling multiple items together in one shipment. We know that retailers are taking steps on their end, for whatever reason, to be more sustainable. What are some forms of messaging retailers could or should leverage to help to deliver this message of sustainability to these consumers who we know are making decisions based on this factor?
Well, again, there are a lot of them. One is really being transparent and open about the environmental impact of different decisions. I was talking with a retail CEO earlier this week, and what she was saying she's doing for her customers and what their company is doing for their customers is to start being transparent. She's in the apparel business, and being transparent about where the costs lie in terms of environmental impact and showing how much of the cost, say, of a pair of jeans is coming from the manufacturing and the water usage and the growing of the cotton and all of that versus, you know, the shipping if they're made overseas versus kind of the last mile delivery. And by being transparent about that, then you can help consumers understand the impact of their decisions, because it's not easy for a consumer right now. You see something and you think, oh, okay, well, is it more environmentally friendly to get in my car and drive to a store and pick that up curbside or shop in the store versus to actually have it delivered to my home? You know, you actually have to think through the trade-offs of you know, my own car, you know, which presumably uses less gas than a truck, but it's just me going by myself versus the truck carrying a number of packages. Is the shipping box more or less sustainable than the bag I might get something in from a store? Those are difficult decisions for consumers, and retailers really have to help consumers understand what the impacts are.
So I should mention once again, and you mentioned it from the outset, this is not your first survey, not only asking about this question, but also indicating this data is the case with consumers using personal values to make a decision about where, when, or how to buy. And I'm kind of curious here because we see, for example, a lot of consumers say that safety is a main concern. You were just talking about consumers weighing these different choices, and you kind of have to weigh, okay, getting three Amazon boxes versus one Walmart trip, how does that balance out? Where is the balance from the consumer perspective in terms of environmental impact and those type of values versus other factors that they might have to take into account?
You know, it's hard to stack up exactly where environmental concerns weigh because consumers make those decisions differently based on their need. We discovered, again, when we did our larger, you know, 30,000 person study a year ago, we looked at these impacts at the product category level. So, you know, kind of apparel and fashion, food and groceries, home, and then beauty and personal care. And we found that consumers make different trade-offs based on the product category and also based kind of on the need state that they have. I think what we were really encouraged by is that for most of the product categories, again, in most of the countries, that we were seeing sustainability and environmental impact increasing. So it's actually equal in the mix with other factors that we think consumers, you know, typically shop based on, notably price, product quality, selection, convenience, those type of things. So it's a much more active part of the decision now rather than something that's only happening among either a small subset of consumers or something that's considered only if you meet all of the other criteria.
I think that's fascinating. And I want to follow up on the portion about, you know, settings or consumer settings might be different, so to speak, for different silos or different categories. What were the main differences that you noticed, not only from this year's survey, but as you mentioned, the prior 30,000 plus person survey regarding how consumers thought about purchasing in grocery versus apparel versus other verticals?
Interestingly, one of the big things we found was that, and this was contrary to I think what we thought going in, we found that the importance of a brand aligning with one's personal values was higher in food and grocery than it was in apparel and fashion. And I think when we went in, we kind of thought about, you know, traditionally people look at groceries and, you know, consumer packaged goods as more commodity purchases, and people look at apparel and fashion as more ego-intensive purchases, things that, you know, much more align with your feeling of self. And so I think we expected it to be the other way. And I think what we found is that, frankly, the apparel market has become more commoditized, and consumers are more concerned about what they put in their body than what they put on their body.
That is fascinating data. Yeah, I think just about everyone in the retail universe would think, you know, just at first glance that it would certainly be the opposite there, but some great insight. I do want to take a brief moment to note potential category growth indicated by your most recent survey that we've been talking about. You know, we've talked on the show in the past about maybe a nesting impact now that people are spending more time at home. Generally, home goods sales have increased. What are some other categories that you found in your survey might be primed for growth this season?
Yeah, so we look at this in a couple of different ways. So in our survey, we kind of looked at the categories that people were indicating they would be spending more on and less on. And we found, you know, not surprisingly, there's a planned increase in groceries, planned increase in electronics, in furniture. Furniture was actually a planned spending increase of a third. And the biggest one, not surprisingly given the environment, was digital entertainment with an increase of almost 40%. On the decline side, again, not surprisingly with COVID, we saw, you know, a 20% planned reduction in spending on dining out, 11% on local outings. And then, as we were talking about, shoes, handbags, accessories, clothing, jewelry, beauty products, all of those showed a planned spending decline this year versus what consumers indicated they spend in a normal year. And when we look at the other set of data that we forecast, which is our sales forecast by retail line of trade, we saw the same thing. You know, we're projecting a upper single digit to low double digit decline in holiday sales in apparel specialty, somewhere around a 40% decline in sales in department stores, yet a 10% increase in sales at grocery, 20% in home improvement, and then 30% in e-commerce. Overall, we're projecting retail sales for the holiday season to be just under 2%, about plus 1.8. But what you see is there's a continued shift toward certain retail lines of trade and away from other retail lines of trade, frankly, that line up very well to the essential versus non-essential retailers who were allowed to remain open back when COVID hit in March and April. We've seen the essential retailers continue to grow at about 14%, 15% since March, where non-essential retail sales are down more than 20% since March in aggregate. And what we feel is starting to happen is those behaviors now are starting to just become habitual. And the longer they persist, the more difficult it's going to be for retailers in the non-essential area, you know, the mall-based retailers, apparel specialty, you know, the retailers that were forced to close. The longer this persists, the harder it's going to be for them to climb out of the hole.
I wanted to use that as my jumping off point for my last question here, because we're about to turn the calendar to 2021. Obviously, IBM has access to all kinds of data on all fronts of retail. Just looking ahead, what is one thing that we should keep an eye on for the next year?
Well, one thing is difficult to keep an eye on. What I would say is, I always like to keep my eye on what's happening with consumers and how they're behaving. And when we start seeing consumers coming back to large public events, whether that's sporting events or whether that's movies or whether that's theater or, you know, conferences that those of us in business always used to go to, when we start seeing a resurgence there, then I think we're going to start seeing some level of what we used to refer to as normalcy in macro consumer behavior. But as long as there is some reluctance there, and so far we're still seeing a lot of reluctance of consumers to re-engage in a lot of those activities, then I think the shift toward digital first and or hybrid models of engagement, the more consumers are reluctant to re-engage physically, the more the digital first and or hybrid models of engagement will become permanent.
Interesting insight as always. Carl, once again, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Trent. Hope you have a good holiday.
Well, it's always great to have Carl on the show. And again, IBM brings to the table a data set that not many can replicate, so it's always great to see their research, not just here in the U.S., but globally as it pertains to retail. So our news story this week is kind of a combo news story and looking ahead. As I mentioned in the open, CBRE held a media conference this week to discuss their annual reverse logistics report, and we hopped on. Of course, CBRE, proverbial friends of the show, so to speak. We've had Megan Martindale joined the show several times to discuss their research. And the reason we're looking at this today is this is their annual report detailing returns and returns logistics for retailers through a real estate lens. And there's a lot of takeaways both through a real estate lens and just for the retail universe. And one of the reasons I find this so fascinating is they poured over a lot of data in this report, some of which I'll throw at you just because I find it intriguing. But the main headline and takeaway is, because of the increase in e-commerce shopping during the holidays, returns are also expected to be higher than in the past. We discussed last year two sets of data that indicated e-commerce purchases typically lead to a greater number of returns than their brick-and-mortar brethren, and CBRE revealed data in this report that indicated that it will be, or could at least be, the same for 2020, even though there's some data out there that says that people maybe aren't planning on returning as many items this year, maybe because of concerns over the pandemic. But again, it's kind of a wait and see approach. And because e-commerce purchases carry that higher rate of returns on a dollar basis, you kind of do wonder if there's going to be this massive push for reverse logistics platforms causing potential log jams in January and February. Now, in CBRE's case, their forecast was based on several different sets of data regarding e-commerce sales increases, but they kind of melded their own data and NRF data for e-commerce sales increases. Now, the NRF calls for about a 40% increase year over year in e-commerce sales this holiday season. Using CBRE's blended data, this puts total e-commerce share for the holiday season at around 32%. So while that is much, much higher than previous years, it's also a far cry from other data that we've discussed that indicate this number may go as high as 50%. And as we've talked about over the last couple of months, consumers interviewed by Deloitte indicate that they plan to spend as much as 70% of their budget via e-commerce. Although, again, this is unlikely to be the case. And if it is the case, certainly we're going to see a massive logistics logjam, primary logistics logjam, not just a reverse logistics logjam, here in the next few weeks. Anyhow, we say all of that to say this. The CBRE data is based on a relatively conservative estimate as it pertains to e-commerce this holiday season versus some of the other estimates that float around out there. So using this estimate, up to $70.5 billion worth of products are expected to be returned in the days and weeks after the holidays. Well, how does that compare to years past? I can throw out the number at you, but really what matters is how it compares to past years. To put it in perspective, this is a 73% increase from the average of the prior 5 years, and it's also a significant bump over last year. And as the report notes, reverse logistics amount to about 59% of the original sales price of a $50 item on average, meaning that if you take a $50 item at a retail store and you return that, the cost to the retailer is going to be about $29 to get that back into their system. And this is a big reason why e-commerce sales struggle to emerge as profitable for many retailers out there. We just talked in Sunday's podcast about how notable it was that Kroger was profitable on the e-commerce front. Well, part of that's because they're not processing as many returns as your typical retailer. Now, obviously that 59% number is going to skew higher or lower based on the total cost of the item. If you have a $30 item, the percentage cost of that item to get it returned and back into your system is going to be much higher. If you have a high dollar or big ticket item, a $200 or $300 or $400 item, that cost to get it back into your system generally going to be a little bit smaller. But again, using a $50 item on average, if you return that item, it's going to cost about $29 to the retailer. Not only are there reverse logistics costs to keep in mind, but there's also an opportunity cost of not having a product back on the shelf. And one of the companies CBRE went to for some of the research in this report was Optoro, which is a reverse logistics software provider. So I do say you want to kind of take this with a grain of salt, of course, but at the same time, they're able to mine a lot of data from this reverse logistics space. The value of fashion apparel, according to Optoro, depreciates by 20 to 50% over each 8 to 16 week period. And that's just kind of a general rule of thumb Optoro's found. Doesn't include returns, but let's say you get a returned clothing item, it is imperative that you get it back on the shelf as soon as you can, because otherwise it could be heading to an off-price store or to your own off-price brands or to your clearance rack. And so that can be a double whammy for those in fashion, because fashion retail also historically has higher return rates from e-commerce purchases than other forms of retail and other silos within retail. Now, to put numbers to the returns impact, brick and mortar sales typically have a return rate of 8 to 10% historically by dollar amount, according to eMarketer. E-commerce sales, however, have historically had a rate of about 25 to 30%. So that's about 3 times higher. And granted, this may be higher or lower simply because the retail universe lacks data for a lot of smaller e-com operators. But again, that's why you're seeing this massive increase in expected returns for holiday season 2020, is because e-commerce returns historically have had a significantly higher return rate, and it would be overly optimistic to think that that won't continue for this year simply because of pandemic conditions. It's not like a shirt is magically going to fit you because there's a pandemic going on. But all that being said, it is very important to keep macro factors in mind. IBM, one of the companies, among others, whose data shows that really we may not see as many returns, or at least customers don't think they're going to return as many items, though we've talked about customer perception not always equaling reality. Now, back to returns here. The steadily increasing movement towards returns, especially returns for e-commerce purchases, has opened the door for these third-party logistics companies to assist retailers in this process. And when you think about third-party logistics firms, the big ones that come to mind, FedEx, UPS, of course, but also the likes of XPO and others. And this is where CBRE took a really interesting look at real estate for third-party logistics operators, which, by the way, currently account for about 27% of large-scale industrial leasing volume, which leads all categories. Just to let you know, e-commerce pure plays account for 22% for perspective. Regular retail accounts for a little over 20%. So these third-party logistics operators have a huge amount of this industrial space in the U.S. And speaking from a strictly industrial real estate standpoint, this may cause a domino effect as far as distribution facilities are concerned, because CBRE expects the increased business going to these third-party logistics operators to maybe push these logistics operators to move into new industrial construction or maybe larger second-generation construction, all of which opens up space for other operators either in or out of that segment, including retail warehouse operators. So it'll be interesting to see if this movement parlays itself over the next 5 years into retailers maybe shifting their distribution centers into new facilities or maybe second generation facilities. And for perspective, CBRE estimates that as much as 400 million square feet over the next 5 years will become devoted to retail returns processing. So it's creating this demand for new or second generation space for these third-party logistics firms. And that means more building of industrial real estate, and that means more movement. So that'll not only impact retailers over the next 5 years, but certainly impact these third-party logistics firms that retailers are partnering with. And it's not just warehouse real estate to note here. Certain retailers are leveraging their healthy brick-and-mortar footprint to assist these third-party operators as well, and some of these third-party services, not necessarily logistics firms. An example in this report given by CBRE includes Walgreens partnering with Narvar to facilitate return services at their stores through use of FedEx on-site services that are offered at most Walgreens. Additionally, something we've discussed in the past, something mentioned by CBRE, you're seeing a lot of malls out there partnering with Happy Returns to provide those returns kiosks in those central marketplaces. Plenty of real estate, of course, to work with there if you're looking at a mall. And as CBRE noted, we're seeing an increase in momentum towards secondary marketplaces as well. Back in January, we had talked with ThredUp about maybe coming on the show for an interview. We couldn't get time worked out or anything, but they gave us a lot of interesting data, and the data indicated massive growth for the secondary apparel sector. But it's not just companies like ThredUp and The RealReal. You're seeing brick-and-mortar mainstays too. Plato's Closet comes to mind. They've dramatically increased their share of the apparel market and their brick-and-mortar footprint over the last 5 years. Now, granted, that's been hampered somewhat by the pandemic and the fact that they weren't seen as an essential retailer, but still, you have to think that a certain percentage of would-be returns will be funneled through these channels for apparel instead of back through the originating retailers, and CBRE certainly speculated as such or indicated as such in the report. Now, I do want to close out all of these fascinating numbers and takeaways from this CBRE call with some customer experience numbers. As far as customer experience was concerned, CBRE's report notes that 42% of customers reported deciding never to shop again at a store after a poor returns experience. It's a pretty high number, and again, perception doesn't always equal reality, but you have to think poor returns experience means probably not going to see that customer be willing to come back too many more times. Meanwhile, 97% of customers will buy from a retailer again. That number, according to Optoro, after a positive returns experience. So, in all, To summarize, we're expecting a larger amount of returns because of the e-commerce market share for the fourth quarter of this year. And we know that customers prefer a positive returns experience. That goes without saying. How that happens on the back end and how retailers make that happen with their third-party logistics firms that they employ, that's going to be certainly something to look ahead to January and February of 2021. Now, let's talk with Vidya Peters of Marqeta regarding another topic of import this holiday season, mobile wallet payments and their use in retailers. Those involved in U.S. retail know when it comes to forms of payments, change sometimes moves at a glacial pace. We noted last year, in fact, a wide-ranging preference to pay with cash, even for purchases under $10, according to one study. But as with so many other things, the pandemic accelerated changes regarding alternate payment methods, including mobile wallets. Joining us today to discuss the rapid update in consumer preference regarding mobile payment solutions is Vidya Peters, the Chief Marketing Officer at Marqeta. Marqeta recently released their 2020 State of Payments report, and we'll be touching on that as well. Vidya, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
First, I was wondering if you minded giving us a bit of a background on what Marqeta does on the day-to-day, just so we have a frame of reference for not only the survey, but also this report.
Sure. Marqeta is the first modern card issuing platform. So if you may think of the cards in your wallet today, they were probably issued by a bank. Marqeta really opened up access to payments infrastructure so any company could issue cards. We have an open API platform that allows companies to build cards that are right for them so that they can pay their gig workers, their customers, their vendors, suppliers, in a way that offers them tremendous control, customization, and access to intelligent data. And so Marqeta serves a variety of customers across different verticals, some of whom empower your day-to-day experiences, such as Instacart and DoorDash, Klarna, and many of the digital banking solutions that you may be using. So very excited to be here with you and talk to you more about the research report that we recently came out with.
Yeah, and let's talk about that research report, because we always like to dive into the makeup anytime we look at a survey or a report. I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit about how the consumer survey was conducted for this report and what the sample size was like as well.
Great. We had 2,000 consumers that we surveyed as a part of this research report, and it was conducted just earlier this quarter. So the data is very much fresh off the press, and we use Propeller Research to conduct this research.
So we've got the background of the survey, how the survey was conducted, and probably the headline coming out of this, and thus part one of the report, was that dramatic increase in use of mobile wallets. What did you find on that front?
We saw a tremendous surge in the use of mobile wallets. So Trent, if you think about it, mobile wallets first came to market with Apple Pay in 2014. And since launch to 2019, so that's 5 years, it took 5 years for mobile wallets to get to roughly between 30 and 40% of usage among consumers. Now, we have seen that surge by 70% in 2020 alone. And so mobile wallets are now at the forefront of how consumers are paying. And we're seeing that people are using mobile wallets for expenses as small or as large as you can imagine, because it's convenient and it's a safer way to pay.
And I think oftentimes the impression is that mobile wallet use is very high amongst maybe millennials and Gen Zers, but you see that fall off maybe amongst baby boomers or the older generation. But your study found that adoption rates are going up amongst those that are older in age as well.
Trent, you're exactly right. That's been the most surprising part of the study. So you typically find the consumers in their 20s or early 30s to be the heaviest users, and that's true. So what we saw is prior to 2020, 50% of people who are 26 to 34 years old were already using mobile wallets. And that is up now, 17 to 18 points, up to 67%. But the biggest jump has actually been the older demographics. We're seeing 35 to 50 year olds who were only using mobile wallets at around 39% in 2019. We're now finding that 80% of them have now jumped to using mobile wallets. We see a similar jump in the older demographic of 51 to 64 year olds, where 22% of them were using mobile wallets in 2019, and that has jumped to 45% in 2020. And this is a pretty big surprise because consumer behavior is incredibly challenging to change. And consumer behavior is particularly harder to change among the older demographics when it comes to payments technology. And so very rarely does an event come along that creates such a sea change in behavior, where the adoption of a new technology grows at such a high rate. And that's what we're seeing with the adoption of mobile wallets.
So we talk about this massive sea change that we've seen really due to the pandemic and maybe some external factors certainly fueling it or helping fuel it. But I think one of the main arguments that's gone on, and it's not just with mobile payment technology, it's with other things, e-commerce adoption and so forth, is to what extent these behaviors will persist after the pandemic is over, whenever that happens to be. And I think that's where your data found some interesting points regarding the fact that this change might be somewhat permanent in terms of mobile wallet adoption.
That's right. I mean, our survey found that 9 out of 10 consumers say that they expect to use their mobile wallets with the same frequency as they are now. So it really tells us that mobile wallets is here to stay. I mean, from an anecdotal perspective, today I find that I don't bring my wallet with me when I'm going shopping because I know all of my cards are already preloaded on my phone. And once you've experienced that level of convenience, it's pretty hard to go back to lugging around all of your cards in your wallet, just from a safety and from a convenience standpoint, let alone touching all of those keys on a terminal, having to click or sign. We're all trying to be as safe as possible. And what we're finding is mobile payments are not only safer and more hygienic, but they're also incredibly the smart thing to do in the time of a pandemic.
I'm curious, was there a number from the study or perhaps a key finding other than what we've discussed in either part one or part two of this report that we're talking about that really jumped out or stood out to you?
Yeah, I think what we're finding is that there's a trifecta of reasons that is driving this surge in mobile payment adoption. And those three reasons are safety, hygiene, and ease. And I think people often assume it's one but not the other. And that's why I think that this time the change or the growth that we're seeing in mobile wallet and mobile payments adoption is here to stay, because if it was just a single reason, you could see that perhaps turning over and going back to old behaviors, perhaps in future years. But with a trifecta of such compelling reasons, I think mobile payments are here to stay.
So to that end, there are a few retailers, some big name retailers, in fact, in the US that have yet to adopt mobile payment technology in their stores, which is interesting because it is something that's fairly easy to adopt. And I was curious, just from your perspective as someone that works with this on the day-to-day, is it a case where some customers might be holding off on adoption until these retailers jump on board, or is it a case where those retailers might need to catch up or risk missing out on the flow to mobile payments?
I think customers are going to be demanding this of retailers. They're going to be asking this of every vendor, every customer, every supplier that they're working with, in order to keep their customer experience safer and more convenient. So I think it's just a matter of time before they adopt mobile payment acceptance. I don't think this is a decision that they can put off for much longer without starting to affect their in-store sales. If behaviors are indeed changing and people are leaving with just their mobile in hand, then they're probably losing out on sales from people at the terminal if they aren't able to accept payment using that method.
I know retailers have certainly lost out on sales to me, for example, because I was in those situations. But in general, we mentioned retailers continuing to adopt this technology, but not only adoption, honing the technology in their store. I was wondering, again, because you're basically on the ground level with this, what are some considerations retailers should keep top of mind as they implement and refine this technology in their stores?
I think speed, Trent, is key at this time. There's no time to be lost. Retail in particular is such a margin sensitive business, and every decision that you're taking could affect conversion at the checkout counter. It could affect the time that it takes to process all of those customers standing in line who are already standing at a socially distanced space and crowding the stores, which is again limited by the number of people that are allowed in at that moment in time. Holiday season is just around the corner. And I think the faster that retailers can adopt mobile payments, the more customers that they can serve, the throughput will be higher in the checkout line. And of course, they can keep their employees and their customers safer in what's already going to be a pretty challenging season.
So we've talked about the state of mobile payment technology in 2020, and we've talked a little bit about what we might see post-pandemic, but I was wondering what developments we might see just in payment technology in general in 2021 and beyond.
It's a good question. I think that what we're going to see is that payments is going to become more and more embedded with the shopping experience. I think that we haven't done enough in truly making that shopping experience more seamless. So if you think about the average customer, they are still picking up their item and going to a checkout line in a retail store, or they are adding it to their virtual basket and then going through a checkout experience. If we look a little bit further at some of the countries or markets where they have been more digitally savvy. For example, in the Netherlands, you have a checkout experience at the grocery store where every customer has a card that allows them to pick up any item off the shelf and quickly scan their card right there on the spot, making that shop buy experience instantaneous and as seamless as possible. And so I think some of that innovation still needs to happen in retail and the e-tail experience, and I think the best is yet to come. But I think there's a ton more that we can do to make that digital experience as convenient, as fast for the customer as possible. And I think the years ahead, we're going to see some interesting experiences come out.
Some excellent insight there. Vidya Peters, once again, the CMO at Marqeta. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It was a pleasure, Trent. Thanks for having me.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Vidya for joining us here today. And because our new segment was a kind of a pseudo looking ahead segment in and of itself, I'm going to leave this last segment of the show to look ahead towards Sunday's podcast, where we'll discuss Academy Sports and Outdoors for the first time in 3 years. Of course, if you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you know that this segment of retail, the sporting goods segment of retail, something near and dear to Leighton and I's heart, and it's probably where I spend the majority of my discretionary income if I'm not spending it at a general merchandise or grocery retailer. We're also going to talk with Keith Cohn, who's the founder of Candy Club. We're going to talk to him about the current state of confectionery retail. That's something that we've only discussed in passing on the show in the past. We've never had an interview guest talk about this. Now, Candy Club services in the five figures in terms of retailers in the U.S. You'll see their products in retailers like Kohl's and Nordstrom Rack and a number of other kind of non-traditional confectionery retailers. So we'll talk to him about, of course, his company and where they're at and where they're looking to go, but also some of the interesting facets of confectionery retail and how social media is playing a big part in candy sales as we head into 2021. I certainly think you'll find that conversation fascinating. It's been one of my favorite interviews to do over the last 12 months, and certainly make sure you hit that subscribe button so that goes automatically to your podcast listening service when that launches on Sunday. Until then, I'm Trent for Leighton saying so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.